described as an orgy of violence. The victim was stripped, burned with cigarettes, whipped, kicked and punched in a two-hour attack. Stephen Wright reports.
The court heard the defendants, who can't be named for legal reasons, were motivated by revenge. The girl was said to have reported the theft of a necklace to social workers, and her actions were seen by her attackers to have caused unpleasant repercussions for one of them. The Recorder of London, Judge Lawrence Verney, ordered a 16-year-old boy who began the cigarette torture in a North London park to be detained for 3 years. Two girls, aged 15 and 17, were detained for 2 years each, and another 17-year-old girl received a 27-month sentence.
In the city, the 100 share index closed down 0.1 at 3142.2. The latest Dow Jones is up 9.39 at 3778.1. London's weather, currently 20 degrees. This evening, dry and bright with sunny spells. Tonight, staying dry but becoming misty in places. Overnight temperatures around 14 degrees in central London. Tomorrow, warm, dry and bright. Temperatures up to 22 degrees with a chance of a shower by the afternoon. It's 4 minutes past seven.
Good evening, this is John Terrett's First Edition. Between now and nine, tomorrow's news tonight. And a very good evening to you on this sunny Monday. John Terrett here till nine. My special guest this evening, Stephen Glover. Stephen is the editor of the London Evening Standard, and we should be talking about what's in tonight's paper and talking around the news agenda of the day very shortly. After half past seven, Barry Fox joins me to talk technology. I'll also be, in this hour, profiling the life and work of Silvana Foer, who is the spokeswoman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. In the news half hour, after 20 years, success for the French, they've caught the world's most wanted terrorist, Carlos the Jackal. But we ask, who now is the world's most wanted terrorist? Mike Theodoulou, our Middle East correspondent, will suggest some names. On the eve of the Pension Ombudsman's report into complaints he's received, we assess the state of the pensions industry. And as LBC transforms into London News 97.3 and London News Talk 11:52, we look ahead to a bright new future as news and information providers for the greatest city in the world. Lindsay Berham has her restaurant guide at half past eight, and Chris Long will be here opening the computer clinic at a quarter to nine. And that's your Monday First Edition.
Oh yay, oh yay! In this, the summer of 1994, the old lady of Threadneedle Street celebrates her 300th birthday. Festivities will take place in the Bank of England Museum. Make way for costumed characters, partake of historic refreshments, and win a mounted £50 note with the free children's activity sheets. The Bank of England Museum, Threadneedle Street. Admission is free. Ring 071-601-5545 for details.
Tomorrow's news tonight on First Edition.
Yes, John Terrett with you until 9 o'clock, and welcome my special guest of the day now, the editor of the Evening Standard, Stuart Stephen. Good evening.
Good evening.
Now, a very big story, one that will be making all forms of media and leading the bulletins today, the capture after some 20 years of Carlos the Jackal, so said the world's most wanted terrorist. Can you just give me a bit of background to him? What's he wanted for?
Well, I mean, first of all, he himself has confessed, apparently, to the French authorities today. He has confessed to 88 separate murders. Now, whether that is Jackal being boastful in the way that only Carlos can, we don't know. But the fact is that for a period, probably between about, between 1972 and 1980 or so, this man and his friends did actually called ravage throughout Europe and the Middle East. It was an extraordinary occasion, an extraordinary period in our history. I think we forget it. Almost you have to be sort of 40-year-old to remember it. One remembers, of course, you know, the great events like the appalling massacre of the Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. But those are the big things. But during the whole of that period, aeroplanes were being hijacked on a regular basis. Diplomats were being murdered. Politicians were being kidnapped. Because, of course, all of these people, all of these terrorists, and Carlos was one of them, were linked. We had the Red Brigade in Italy. We had the Carlo, the Baader-Meinhof group in Germany. We had the IRA in Ireland and in this country. We had the Iranian Liberation Movement. We had the Liberation Army of Turkey. We had a large number of very, very vicious terrorist groups who were all joined together under one determination, and that was to sort of basically to wreck the Western world. And they were enormously highly motivated, and more significantly perhaps, they were also highly trained, in some cases in Beirut, the refugee camps there, others in Russia. They were also properly financed. They were financed by the KGB and by the oil-rich Arab states during that period. And during that time, the security services of the Western world were actually at wit's end, and the Western world was in danger of being destabilized by them. And this man was the one most ruthless of them all. He was just a killer. He actually was not an ideological man at all. He was in it for the money. He was in it for the girls, which were provided him in plenty by his paymasters. He was in it for the sheer pleasure and fun of killing. To capture him after all this time, when in fact the world is to a certain extent free of terrorism, I think is a triumph.
Well, I was going to say, he hasn't been active for quite a while, has he? Or has he?
No, I don't think he has. No. I think that he has from time to time. I mean, actually, one can look at his career and say that it was actually properly over in about 1982, 1983. Thereafter, he went purely freelance. We don't know precisely what he was doing during that period, but there were some indications that he was working for a period for the Syrians and then for the Libyans and so on. He was sort of picked up by various security services, paid, looked after, and sent off on freelance missions. Precisely what he then did, we don't know.
I'm just looking at your front page tonight and the headline which says, "At last they've caught the jackal." I'm just looking to see whether I can see how old he is. I mean, how old do you think he probably is now?
I would think he must be in his mid-50s. Yeah. We know him quite well in this country, actually. The security services have got enormous files on him because he came from a middle-class Venezuelan family. His father was a lawyer in Colombia, quite well off, but also a Stalinist communist. He came over to this country, went to the LSE, and from the LSE, he went to Patrice Lumumba University. And then for his early days as a terrorist, he lived here. And the reason he lived here was because we were the only people in the world, our intelligence services, MI5 at the time, the only people who refused to take the warnings of the Israelis seriously as to the presence of a large number of very, very dangerous terrorists running amok in the Western world. And so this was, for a period, the safest place for him to live.
And surely the key question is, how can a man whose face is on every wanted poster in the world pretty well, and certainly on the file of every police force, how can a man evade capture for so long when his crimes are so high profile?
Well, first of all, he was described as a master of disguise, and I think that was probably a bit of journalese there, but I mean, clearly he was very good at that. But essentially, the reason that he could escape was, and could do what he did, was because he was a part of what is known as state terrorism. He was being looked after not by small little groups of freelance terrorists operating for their own purposes. He was looked after by countries. It was state terrorism. So he would be flown around by private jets from one country to another. He would be traveling on diplomatic passports. He was a part and parcel of those terrorist nations like the Libyans, like the Iraqis, like the Syrians, who have such people operating, who move their arms in diplomatic pouches. They are terrorist states, and he was their arm.
And yet the end, Stuart, when it finally came for him yesterday or whenever it was in Khartoum in the Sudan. What a funny place to be.
Very odd. And indeed, it was said that he was there seeking to destabilise the Sudanese government. Now, whether that or so or not, also we don't know. What I think is clear is that people had lost patience with him. We heard during the 70s and 80s, time and time again, he's moving on from one country to the other. Eventually, he ran out of countries. The French had him very much on their wanted list because he had murdered some French policemen, that we know. And the Israelis, of course, constantly tabbing him. So when the time came, when that moment, which I suppose was inevitable, that every country in the world felt they'd had enough of Carlos, that the time had come to cut all ties with him. Mm. That moment was inevitable. And when that moment came, there were the secret services of a Western power ready to pick him up.
Yes,
I imagine that the Israelis had something to do with that as well.
Yes, but the credit goes to the French.
Most certainly.
Yes.
Yes, certainly. And indeed, he did commit most of his greatest atrocities on French soil. Namely, the murder of French policemen.
Yes, and he has been tried in his absence, hasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Presumably, he will have a chance to answer that.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, I don't know quite what the French judicial system would be and how it would work under circumstances of this kind. I think that it's clear that he is a murderer, and he himself apparently has confessed, as I say, to 88 murders.
Yes, an awful lot. Do you know whether he had any distinctive, definite links with the IRA?
In 1972, there was a conference of all the world terror organizations in a Badani refugee camp in Beirut. Present at that conference were the PFL, the PLO, the IRA, and the Red Brigade and all the rest of them. And for the period between that conference and about 1980, all of these groups were working closer together. Now, whether or not Carlos himself actually was involved in any IRA specific operations, we don't know. I don't think he was, as a matter of fact, because the IRA themselves were quite capable of operating themselves. But he certainly was in contact with them, certainly was in touch with them. Certainly his people, the people he's working with, were also working with the IRA during that time.
Mm. Now, Middle Eastern terrorism has mercifully gone a bit quiet for the time being. Let's hope it stays that way. Is that because Moscow can no longer afford to sponsor them?
I think that's one very, very strong reason for it. The Moscow itself is no longer interested in terrorism. But also, the Arab countries of the Gulf now feel secure enough, not themselves, to pay vast millions, which they used to, into the coffers of the PFLP and the PLO and so on, as kind of blackmail money. Mm. That they were allowed to remain, continue without terrorism within their borders, provided they paid that money.
And the bombs that went off here a couple of weeks ago, the link goes to Iran.
That link probably goes to Iran, yes.
Yeah, yeah. OK, well, thank you for discussing that one in full. Stuart Stephen, editor of the London Evening Standard. We'll be back with Stuart to talk about what else is in tonight's paper and on the news agenda of the day after the finance news, and that comes up after this.
Call the Charter Nightingale Counselling Centre on 071 258 3828 for confidential counselling and help with a variety of problems like stress and depression, eating disorders, alcohol and drug dependency. Charter Nightingale is a private centre and offers complete confidentiality. If you would like to know more about how we can help you, call any time, day or night, on 071 258 3828.
First Edition Finance.
7:16, time to see what'll be on the City pages tomorrow, and welcome Graham Sidwell.
Thank you, John. Well, the Evening Standard, like us, has the advantage of being able to carry today's City News today, whereas the morning papers have to wait all day to carry what will probably turn out to be tomorrow's main story, the results of the final High Street Bank to report its figures. The Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, better known to you and me by its UK subsidiary, the Midland Bank. It's the last of the High Street banks to file, and like the others, it boosted profits by cutting down the money it's put aside to cover bad debts. The Midlands slashed from £321 to £54 million, and Hong Kong and Shanghai halved it to about £173 million. So Honkers and Shankers' profits were up 24% to £1.46 billion, and the Midlands up £58 million to £443 million. But the Evening Standard highlighted, as may the papers in the morning, the fact that they've made a pretty poor fist of their share in money market dealings, and that worried the city. The shares were down 10 pence at 7.49. Otherwise, it was a bit of a quiet day because it's an Assumption Day holiday on the continent, and we're waiting for the Americans to decide whether or not they're going to raise interest rates. We won't find that out till tomorrow unless they slip something in after I go home tonight. It's always possible. The Germans, by the way, meet on Thursday for their Bundesbank Council meeting. They may well cut rates over there, so We don't know which way things are going. Share trading light today, lightest of the month. 463 million shares traded. The FTSE 100 index ended down just 0.1 at 3142.2. And upcoming tomorrow, well, as I say, the US Federal Reserve decides whether or not or how much it's going to raise interest rates. Apart from that, the CBI is coming out with its usual monthly snapshot of how they feels the state of the high streets are, and that will be in the papers in the morning. The actual numbers come out from the Central Statistical Office on Thursday, so there's a little bit of a lag there. We get the July government borrowing numbers tomorrow as well, and the major company producing figures tomorrow is the insurance broker Sedgwick's. They're predicting a rise from 54 to around £59 million. And the motor dealer Evans Horshaw. Its half-timers tomorrow should reflect the better business in Britain's car showrooms, though not quite as good in August this year, apparently, as last year. But Evans Horshaw's profits should almost double to about £6.7 million, and we'll report on that this time tomorrow night.
OK, sir. Thank you very much, Graham Sidwell, who will return at 8:45 tonight with the final numbers check of the day. There is something else related with figures which happens tomorrow. The Pension Ombudsman will report tomorrow, and at about 8:15 tonight, I'll be talking to Norma Cohen, who is the investments correspondent of the FT. We'll be looking at the state of the pensions industry. Quite a big topic. 18 minutes past seven is the time. This is First Edition, and John Terrett here till nine. Stuart Stephen is the editor of the Evening Standard. He's my guest, and more from him after this.
A couple of months ago, the Computer Shopping Club advertised on LBC, and to find out how they got on, I've come to meet Farhad Aladdin. Farhad, how did LBC compare with other media?
When you use conventional advertising on specialised magazines and computer magazines, the level of calls coming in, you cannot compare it. I mean, LBC was superb.
And did the campaign open up any new markets for you?
The big ones, or let's say the corporate customers and the businesses with multiple computers, it was our first time that we hit this kind of businesses, and that was definitely through LBC.
Put LBC to work for your business. Call the sales team during office hours on 071 973 1152.
Tomorrow's news tonight on First Edition.
Yes, good evening from John Terrett. Back to Stuart Stephen, the editor of the Evening Standard. And we've spent the first part, Stuart, talking about international terrorism. I noticed today that the IRA admitted planting the two bike bombs in Bognor and in Brighton.
Well, I think bike bombs in Bognor and Brighton to celebrate the 25th anniversary of British troops arriving in Belfast is a sad and tragic event, and it really does show, one could almost use the word, the depravity which the IRA has fallen to in that period. They, of course, say that these bombs were not intended to harm people and that warnings were given, but really, you cannot put bombs into an area which has no strategic significance of any kind whatsoever, just ordinary people are wandering about, and plant a bomb, and not expect for there to be some terrible, terrible accident and, whatever your intention, for people to be killed or maimed by it. And so I don't think anybody will accept the view that this was not dangerous. Everybody will accept the view that this is contemptible.
What about the change of tactic, using these mountain bikes for the first time? Is it significant or is it a bit... Well, I was going to say silly, but of course it's never silly when you're dealing with explosives.
Well, it's never silly because explosives can kill, and however small the explosives, they can kill. And I also think it's probably wrong to say they have now been reduced to mountain bikes. It does sound, you know, very sort of small,
yes,
compared to the terrible car bombs which we've had in the past, because we don't know what is planned next. So I'm not going to crow about it. All I say is that this action, I think, should leave us all feeling contemptuous of those who planned it.
There have been some successes lately, haven't there? They've managed to pick up quite a large amount of explosive and stuff like that in various places around the country.
You know, one desperately hopes that the security services are on top of it now. It's about time, of course, but one desperately hopes that this is the case. And one hopes also that the fact that they've launched this very, very small response to what was, in fact, a sort of major moment in the history of Ireland and Northern Ireland, one is tempted to say that this indicates something very significant in the fact that they cannot respond to the way they used to. But I will not be drawn down that path. I just think it's very dangerous. One does not know what the IRA will do tomorrow. One does not know if at this very moment there is not some appalling atrocity being planned.
Yes, I think we'll leave it at that point in the light of what you say. I was going to draw you down that road, and I've pulled back from doing so. Let's change topic then and talk instead about Michael Portillo. who was in the news last week because he intended to end the priority contracts for companies who employ disabled people. Europe said, Mr. Portillo, you don't have to do it. And now Europe is saying, well, maybe you're right after all.
Well, I don't think Europe is actually saying that. The chapter of events really is quite extraordinary. Here is a new minister, Department of Employment, who, almost on the day he reaches office, announces that he is going to bring to an end proposals which would allow the government to especially look after companies which employ people who are
disabled.
And he pulls the plug on this, and he blames Europe. Europe says immediately, this is nonsense. This is not what our legislation was intended to be. And he, almost on his knees, begs Europe to say, yes, your legislation does say that. My lawyers say it says that. And Europe says, no, you're misreading it. And he begs it. He says, no, come on, this is what you are saying. And Europe says, well, maybe, and that's what they said today, maybe you could read it in the way you're suggesting. Now, I don't understand what is going on here. Either this man is determined to end this concession to the disabled, in which case he is using Europe as an excuse to do so, or he is not so determined, in which case, what the hell is he doing? Why is he playing this ridiculous game? I think that Portillo comes out of this very badly indeed. I think he's hiding behind, or trying to hide behind, the skirts of the European Commission to do something which is deeply unpleasant.
But how odd that the biggest Eurosceptic in the cabinet should do that.
Well, it just shows the sort of weakness of his position. I think that possibly he is hoping, by doing this, to persuade all of us that Europe is even worse than we imagine it to be. I think that may be part of the tactic. But whatever it is, it is a cynical misuse of European legislation to seek to hide behind it. Now, if he is honest, if what he says, and what he says is, I do not wish to do this, but I'm being forced to do it by Europe, then surely the posture is, I thought I was being asked to do it by Europe. I'm relieved beyond all measure to learn that Europe now says that I don't have to do it, and that is the end of the matter. Europe having said this, I know that I'm not going to be called before the Commission for being in breach of European laws. I know that I'm not going to be called before the European Court of Justice for disobeying a directive, because I have specifically been told that my reading of the legislation is incorrect. So, whatever way you look at it, he, Portillo, comes out reeking, in my view, of insincerity and dishonesty.
I just want to tackle you on, or get you to talk a little bit about the Home Secretary, who was in the news this morning because he is planning, apparently, to recruit civilians to patrol the streets. Now, Labour's attacked the idea today. What does the Evening Standard think of it?
Well, I think that this is one of those ideas which possibly has been overstated. I mean, there's no doubt about it, the Neighbourhood Watch scheme, where it has properly been applied, has worked really reasonably well. I think really all that Michael Howard is saying, that we should slightly extend that people should look out for what goes on in their streets, take a bit of responsibility for their locality, in a way slightly beyond the Neighbourhood Watch scheme. That's what I take it to mean. I don't think that Michael Howard is suggesting we should have vigilantes marching up and down wearing funny uniforms and beating suspicious people over the head with clubs.
But what about the reaction of the Police Federation, who've been jumping up and down today, as they always do, saying, don't take any powers away from the police?
Well, I mean, the Police Federation, I think it's their job to jump up and down. They do tend to do that. As I say, I think this has all been very much exaggerated. The Neighbourhood Watch scheme, you know, when it first came in, was much derided. And I think I was probably one of those who was deriding it. I thought it was sort of nonsensical. People came round to my house and asked me to stick things in my window, and I told them to sort of take a flying jump. But I now see, actually, that if properly sort of managed locally, it can work. In my own locality, there have been occasions when burglars have not burgled a house because of a neighbourhood watch scheme. So these things can work. It is really a question of the community. People saying for themselves, we can't leave everything for the authorities to do. We can't expect the authorities to look after everything. We must take a bit of responsibility unto ourselves.
OK, and I wonder if I could just get your opinion on one of the big London stories tonight. This business of Wandsworth allegedly passing houses, homeless people on to other boroughs. Now, this features in a panorama programme on the BBC tonight.
Well, I think this is yet another example, yet another tragic example of why it is that London desperately needs a central strategic authority. The moment that the GLC died was the moment that councils began playing these sort of games, because they are responsible only to themselves. And I don't want to see a new GLC because it was a vast, vast bureaucracy, but I do want to see a central strategic authority in London, because if you had such a thing, then this kind of thing, where one rich borough, or one borough which feels that it's got that it doesn't need to sort of take problems, can export them to neighbouring boroughs. If you had a strategic authority, then that simply could not happen. It would not be allowed to happen. And if, therefore, Londoners at the next election are asked whether or not they want some kind of authority, and they're asked by a political party to vote for them because that political party is capable of giving them such authority, then I think that this very story tonight is one reason why they should say, yes, we want an authority for London. London must have a central voice.
Dealing with all areas of council work?
Dealing, overriding, overarching council. There must be a place called London. There isn't actually a place called London at present. There's a place that's called Streatham, there's a place called Wandsworth, there's a place that's called Chelsea, Westminster, Hackney and so on. There isn't a place called London. So we must have London. We must give London back to the Londoners. Or Londoners must have a place called London. We must have a place, and we must have an authority to which we can appeal, which can look after our interests, which stops councils behaving in this way.
Stuart, thank you for joining us on the programme this evening and giving your views. Stuart Stephen is the editor of the London Evening Standard, and he brings the time to 7:29. Let's get the roads now. What's happening, Victoria Smith?
Well, still busy out there. Starting off in the east, the Blackwell Tunnel Southern Approach, a bit slow from an earlier overheight vehicle. That's just being cleared out. And a bit slow in the Blackwell Tunnel Northern Approach as well, about a mile of queuing traffic there. In Brixton, we've got the remains of an accident. Acre Lane near the junction of the A23 Brixton Road. That's very slow westbound. It's also slow southbound on the A23. That's causing the traffic to clog up through the town centre. Busy in the west in New Malden, the A3 Kingston Bypass near Bushy Road. Southbound has one lane taken out there. And also slow in Marylebone Road, westbound from the King's Cross one-way system up to Baker Street. Over on the Underground, the same situation we've had all evening. Delays on the Circle, Hammersmith and City and the Metropolitan lines, and no service on the District line between Richmond and Turnham Green.
If your computer has a modem, then drive it on the electronic superhighway by logging onto Cosmos BBS on 081 690 5558. That's 081 690 5558.
Victoria Smith of the LBC Traffic Centre.
Do you think this will suit my wife?
I've never actually met your wife, sir.
She's got red hair.
Well, the colour would go. What size is she?
About so high.
I see. And what are her measurements?
About this big.
I see. Well, size 14, I should think. This one, perhaps.
What if it doesn't fit?
No problem. We'll give you your money back.
Oh, in that case, I'll play safe and take a size 12.
If you're not happy with anything you buy at Heathrow, Gatwick, Stansted or any BAA airport, just return it with a receipt and we'll exchange it or give you your money back. And that's guaranteed.
LBC News Talk 97.3. News.
Now, the 7:30 headlines. One of the world's most wanted terrorists is in a French jail tonight after being handed over by the Sudanese government. It's claimed that Carlos the Jackal is responsible for 83 deaths worldwide. He'd been on the run for 20 years. Carlos will now stand trial in France. The IRA has admitted responsibility for two bike bombs on the south coast. 15 shops were wrecked by an explosion in a shopping precinct at Bognor. Another device near the Palace Pier in Brighton was blown up by experts. The Tory leaders of Wandsworth Council have hit back at claims that they're palming off homeless families onto other London boroughs. Tonight's panorama programme alleges half the families housed in private rented accommodation were sent to Lambeth, Merton or Croydon. Wandsworth says the private sector is helping deal with homelessness. It's emerged that the man who murdered chambermaid Sandra Parkinson in Devon may have been a serial killer and a rapist responsible for over 30 crimes. Police are re-examining files on cases dating back 14 years after Alan Connor was found hanged from a tree in Cambridgeshire. The weather, 20 degrees in the west of town, this evening clear and bright. Tonight staying dry but becoming misty in places, and the overnight temperature 14 in town. Tomorrow warm, dry and bright, and the top temperature 22 degrees with the chance of a shower by the afternoon. Now, quite an exciting half an hour coming up. We've got the sport with Tony Lockwood, of course. I'll be profiling Silvana Foer, the life and work of Silvana. She is the spokeswoman for the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She spends her life briefing the world's media. And without her, we would not be able to report so accurately stories which are, even as I speak, unfolding in places like Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and in the past in Somalia and in Iraq. So Silvana coming up on the programme, but after the break, it's Barry Fox talking technology.
Buy a new Nissan before 31st of August for our best-ever MREG deals. Drive away a 16-valve 1.4-litre Sunny for only $7,995, or a special edition Micra Tropic, still available for just $6,495 on the road. And remember, every new Nissan has a full 3-year 60,000-mile manufacturer's warranty, absolutely free. So don't miss out. Visit your Greater London Nissan dealer before 31st of August and get the best value for your money.
You can with a Nissan.
Hello, this is Frank Boff with an invitation to you to join me each weekday afternoon here on LBC. We have a whole variety of subjects on which we can give you help, from property to the law, from alternative health to holidays and travel. Do join me when you're able on LBC News Talk 97.3 FM.
This is First Edition.
26 minutes to 8. Let's talk technology for the next 10 minutes or so with our man in the know, the one and only Barry Fox. Barry, good evening.
Good evening.
Now, Nintendo has lost $200 million, apparently.
Yes, in the States.
It's not a laughing matter if you lose $200 million.
I tell you, no, why I'm laughing is that it's the first time that I've seen Nintendo. Nintendo normally don't say very much. But, I mean, when you see the statements that have come out of them in the States, I mean, referring to the court decision as, quote, they're appalled at it, it's irrational, preposterous, flat wrong, grossly inflated, defies belief. I mean, the reason I laugh is that Nintendo is normally a company that really doesn't want to talk to the press, but suddenly they see the press as an ally. Now, what happened was this. Back in 1975, a couple of American inventors filed a patent over there on a very early improvement on the video games. If you remember, 20 years ago, video games were ping pong, electronic ping pong. And you went out and bought a game that would only play one game. It was the electronic thing you plugged into the mainstream TV. It would only play one game. Now, they came up with the idea of having a game into which you could plug the different cartridges, which played a whole range of games. And that really was the beginning of the games era as we know it now. Now, around 1980, they took on all the companies in the States saying, you are infringing our patent, and Nintendo was one of them. A lot of the country's companies settled behind the scenes, but Nintendo said no, wouldn't settle. Although the company, which was called Alpex, went out of business in 1983, it ran out of money and went bankrupt, the case has been kept alive, probably because lawyers over there work on contingency basis, you know, no fee but a share of the damages. And this finally came to a court in New York a week or so ago. Now, they spent a month in the court discussing this case, and I spent Saturday reading the patent, and believe me, it is not an easy document to read. I can understand it was not a happy day for me, and I can imagine it was not a happy day for this jury in the New York court who spent a month hearing the arguments about whether Nintendo's NES games do or do not infringe. Anyway, what really seems to upset Nintendo is the fact that after a month's hearing, the jury decided in 5 hours, yes, Nintendo does infringe, and the damages should be $208 million. And that's why Nintendo is so angry. They say that the, I quote, the jury simply misunderstood the case. And I have to say, I think it's probably very likely they did. I think they just couldn't understand it.
The Sunday Times published a story yesterday on CDs which don't work properly. Did you read that?
Yes. There was it's a most interesting situation. This comes out. It seems that newspapers reckon that the way to sell newspapers, there's probably two ways now. You know, does it cure cancer, and does it prove that CDs are a bad thing? And we've got yet another scare coming up on the fact that supposedly one in four owners of CD players find that they're no better than vinyl. They skip and they jump and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get down to it, and when you look behind this story, there really isn't any evidence. It turns out that what the quote evidence quoted was some work done by some business studies students at a couple of universities who went out and asked people whether they had problems with CDs, and inevitably, of course, some do. But in general, the situation is that it's cheap CD players that give the problems, and that's very different from saying that CDs are unreliable and no better than vinyl LPs. And the guts of it is that there are, without doubt, some dud CDs on the market because they're made by pressing plants which are cutting corners. And if you really get a dud one, then you take it back to the shop and you ask for it to be changed. And that very soon knocks down the line that the record company, that means the record company loses money, so they kick the pressing plant to do better. But to say one in four is really very misleading, because you will quite often find with CDs that even if you get one that won't play, just take it out of the player and put it back in again. And that often will center the thing better in the tray in the player. There's no magic in that. It's just that the CDs often don't center properly in the tray of the player. And if they've got any surface dust on, you can just wipe it off with a cloth. And you'll often find that explains why a CD mysteriously won't play sometimes. There's nothing actually wrong with it.
That's good advice coming for you, Barry. Thank you for that. And I wonder whether you can just tell us fairly quickly about the existing driving licences. Now, a lot of fuss last week about the potential new ones, but you're saying there's information which you can read if you know where to look on the existing ones.
Yes, I'm saying that it really shows why some of the fuss seems to be a bit misplaced. If you look at an ordinary driving licence, some people know this, some people don't. Your date of birth and your sex, male or female, is not evident there. It's supposed to be, you know, you look at it, you don't know who you are, whatever. Okay, in fact, if you look at the six-figure number at the top of the page of the driving license, the driver six-figure number, that codes your date of birth and your sex. Now, we've only got a moment, so it's difficult to explain how to do it, but I'll tell you the key to this is look at the second digit. And if you bear in mind that if you are female, they add a 5 to that, and if you're male, they don't, then everything else falls into place. You'll see how your date of birth comes into those numbers. And that's why the police are able to know immediately they ask for your license, you know, whether you're the person you pretend to be, because they can ask you your age and they can check it with your license number.
Barry, that's great to hear. Thank you for giving that secret away. Most interesting. Barry Fox talks technology every week on this programme. He'll be back, all being well, next week at the same time. Now, this is First Edition, and it's John Terrett here with you until 9 o'clock. Time now, 20 to 8.
Sport on First Edition.
And with me this evening is Tony Lockwood, and we're going to talk quite a bit of cricket, starting with Warwickshire, whose unbeaten record so far has gone out the window.
Yes, it went today, John, beaten by Notts and innings and 43 runs at Edgbaston. That was the victory margin, a duck for the high-scoring, record-breaking batsman Brian Lara. And suddenly Warwickshire, who were on for the Grand Slam, looked as if they'd win all four trophies. I'm not saying they won't win the championship, but this has made a real fight of it, a battle at the top, because Leicestershire have managed to move into second place. That's courtesy of a 97-run win over Worcestershire. And Surrey have been finding it difficult going recently. They were in second place. They've now been displaced by Leicestershire. Surrey thrashed by Essex. An innings and 87 runs. The off-spinner Peter Such doing much of the damage in that championship game. Good victory for Derbyshire. Devon Malcolm, again, the match winner, and he'll be back in action, we think, for Thursday's test at the Oval. And Middlesex, another England player, Phil Tufnell, good match figures, 4 for 17, and they beat Somerset at Lord's. So suddenly the championship race, as we come into the you know, the final furlong, so to speak, is hotting up, and Warwick should have a little bit of resistance there to deal with.
Sure. Can they fight back? Are they...
Well, they've looked outstanding this season, and that's the arrival of Brian Lara, because not only has he scored runs in all competitions, but those around him have been inspired and motivated, and that's been the difference. They also have, I think, one of the best captains in county cricket in Dermot Reeve, and they have a lot of other very outstanding players, and they, in past seasons, haven't really received that amount of publicity or haven't looked a side that could dominate cricket in all the competitions. Lara's arrival has changed all that.
It's amazing the effect that one man can have, yes. Let's talk about the selectors who made this decision yesterday, or it was announced yesterday, that Mike Gatting would come in as cover for an injured Graham Gooch.
Yes, he's come in. The problem is that Gooch has declared himself fully fit for Thursday. He's been struggling to shake off a niggling hamstring injury, so Gooch will play, which means Gatting is left on the sidelines. But although he won't play, it's an indication, I think, that the selectors believe that at 37, Mike Gatting is still in a position and playing well enough to tour this winter for the Ashes Test in Australia. And that's really, we have to say, what Gatting's objective was. He's had a commanding season in charge of Middlesex. He's scored runs. His average is extremely healthy. He's a player of great experience, and I think he would be a welcome addition to the Ashes party. So even though he might not play, I think he will be named in the travelling squad later on this year. Joey Benjamin, incidentally, the Surrey pace bowler, he, I'm almost certain, will make his debut on his home ground. It's a pacey, bouncy track at the Oval. Devon Malcolm's come in for Angus Fraser, and Benjamin is a great swing bowler, and that pitch will suit him. So I think we're going to see another local-based player given an opportunity at England level.
Well, good for them, and it's a tremendous credit to Mike Gatting, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, he's come back. He's had his problems. Of course, he was successful in the late 80s, that Ashes tour. He's always said, whatever's happened with the problems in Pakistan, the fact that the captaincy was taken off him, the tour of South Africa, which caused such a storm, he has continued to score runs, and he's really pressed his way into the selectors' thoughts, and now he's at least received a reward and an indication that maybe he can still travel to Australia later in the year.
Okay, and now let's talk about the weekend motor racing. Schumacher did it, of course, didn't he?
Yes, he did. 31 points, and at the moment, it's difficult to see Damon Hill whittling that away, although we know, we've discussed on this programme, Schumacher with a two-race ban. The Italian Grand Prix, and this is amazing, the problems that the sports governing body, the FIA, have. They've only announced in the last hour or so that the Grand Prix at Monza that was called off because of worries over safety will now go ahead. So it's been reinstated. Oh.
So they are straightening the track, then?
They are now going to carry out the necessary safety work. There was a plea from the Italian Parliament. It's back on, which is good for the sport, and that will hopefully make it a more competitive end to the season.
But tell me about Nigel Mansell, because there's some doubt as to whether he'll even race again.
A big doubt at the moment. Seventh at Lexington this weekend, really struggling, the reigning IndyCar champion. And he must have been unsettled by the news that Carl Haas, who is one part of the Newman Haas team, has been talking to the Canadian driver Paul Tracy. When you take into consideration that Michael Andretti has already been signed up by the Newman Haas team for next season, you wonder where Mansell fits into the jigsaw. He's 41, he's a multimillionaire, his family are based in Florida. He left Formula One having achieved everything. Now, we expect him to feature for the last three races of the season, the three Grand Prix, Spain, Japan and Australia, but there's no actual sign that they will sign him up full-time to replace the team of Damon Hill and David Coulthard next season. So, although I'm not saying that he's without a drive, it must be a little worrying for him, because he could just be shut out completely. And at 41, does he want to continue? Doesn't need to financially. Does he want to branch out? Does he want to try other sports, other business adventures? So that's a bit of a problem at the moment for Mansell, because there doesn't seem an obvious ride or an obvious drive for him next season.
OK, one to watch. And any other headlines?
Just very briefly, the World Cycling Championships in Sicily. Graham Obrey, the defending champion, thrown out. They said, well, your style of racing is unsafe and you've ignored repeated warnings about the racing position you take up. So that means Chris Boardman, Olympic champion, is favourite for the final tomorrow. And doesn't take long, does it? Managerial casualty, 48 hours into the season. Player manager of Brecon City, Ian Redford, has had enough. 2 days in, 5-1, thrashing at the weekend at home to Meadowbank. So he said bye-bye.
Okay, and bye-bye to you, Tony.
Thank you, John.
The LBC Oxfam Gala Variety Show for our London People's Plane for Rwanda, Sunday the 21st of August.
Come fly with
a glittering evening with a lineup of stars including Topol, Elizabeth Welch, Ron Moody, the stars of Phantom of the Opera and Betty Buckley from Sunset Boulevard, plus the chart-topping Larry Adler, and the stars, the full orchestra and the sumptuous settings from the Gershwin musical Crazy for You. Don't miss Come Fly With Me at the Prince Edward Theatre, 7 p.m. Sunday the 21st of August. Tickets from £15 are available now. Call the LBC ticket line on 071 379 3742. That's 379 3742.
This is First Edition.
And it's 13 minutes to 8. Good evening from John Terrett. Now, the Kurdish refugee crisis, famine in Somalia, bitter, bitter fighting in former Yugoslavia, and now the migration crisis unfolding on the borders of Rwanda and Zaire. The United Nations has been involved in all these hotspots, and news of each success and failure has been passed to the world's media, which is always hungry for information. So much information required. By spokesperson Silvana Foer. Silvana has been on LBC countless times. I can't remember how many times. It's just countless. Tonight on First Edition, we're presenting a profile of Silvana, former New York Times journalist, foreign correspondent and now press officer for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. It is said that most of us would never have heard of UNHCR had it not been for Silvana, who's described as noisy, undiplomatic, exhausting and very, very good at her job. She's on the line to us now from her home in Geneva. Silvana, good evening.
Good evening.
You wanted to be a lawyer, apparently, but I understand you kept being arrested during human rights demonstrations back in the States.
Yes, back in the 60s. I think I went to every single civil rights demonstration there was, and I kept getting jailed. And finally my advisor said to me, forget it, you're never going to pass a bar exam. You better change your major.
So you ended up working for the New York Times. Now, that's a pretty good paper.
Well, actually, I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration. What I did is I called the New York Times and I said, my name is Silvana Foer and I want to be a foreign correspondent. And they said, okay, we have a job for you taking classified ads on the telephone. So I decided they didn't quite have the idea, so I got on a plane and flew to Vietnam.
And you phoned them up from Vietnam, presumably, and said, I'm here and I've got a story.
That's right. And I started selling stories to them, and then I went to work for Newsweek, and then I went to Cambodia to cover the war there. And I started a wonderful, wonderful career, much, much better than being a lawyer.
At what point did you arrive in Vietnam, Silvana? What did you witness?
Well, I got there in the late 60s, just after Tet, the Tet Offensive. And I saw basically the failure of American troops and what it was doing to morale. And I saw the communists making gains very steadily. And then, of course, the war shifted to Cambodia in 1970, and Newsweek sent me off there. And I think probably it was the most exciting time of my life. It was a time of 400 or 500 rockets on the Capitol every single night and not being able to sleep because the white light of in the sky from the B-52 bombings just prevented you from ever getting a good night's sleep.
Sure. I mean, very, very dangerous to be in those kind of circumstances.
Yeah, but you made wonderful friends, and I really was living a kind of history that most people never have the opportunity to do.
There's something about that conflict, isn't there, Vietnam and Cambodia, which is uniquely intriguing to people who weren't there, and bonding among human beings for people that were.
That's right. I think that's how I got interested in refugees, because I made so many friends in Vietnam and Cambodia. And then in the middle 70s and late 70s, when we started seeing these people fleeing in terror, you had to reach out and try and do something to help them.
The thing is, though, I'm told that you railed quite a lot against the UNHCR and its work at the time that you were a foreign correspondent.
Yes, that's right. I think when you're a journalist, you really see the weak points of any UN organization. And I felt that UNHCR never took a very, very strong stand on refugee issues. They didn't point the finger at governments and say, why aren't you doing something to stop the pirates raping these Vietnamese boat people? Why aren't you stopping the killing of refugees? Why aren't you stopping and saying something when 40,000 refugees are driven back across the border into a minefield? And that's why I like the present High Commissioner so much, because she is willing to take a stand and to point fingers and to pound her fist on the table and say, hey, you got to cut that out. That's what we're here to protect these people.
Well, how does a girl from your background get on with Sagato Ogata, who comes from a very upper-crust Japanese family?
Well, we get along very, very well. We had a long talk before I took this job, and I explained to her my theory of dealing with the public, and I felt that we should tell people quite honestly what our failings were, what was wrong. And I said, it's much better for us to go up front and say to people, this is where we're falling down. People are dying because we cannot cope with this thing or that thing. And she said, I agree. Go ahead. Let's do it, because we really need all the help we can get. You know that there are 10,000 new refugees created every single day of every single year in the last 3 years. This is a very, very scary number, and we need to keep refugees on the front pages and on LBC.
Well, now, this is interesting, because there are something like 23 million refugees worldwide, apparently, and yet the UNHCR is seen as somewhat of a backwater in the organization.
Well, UNHCR, I think, is one of the smaller organizations. We haven't been able to grow with the numbers of refugees, and there are so many things that we should be doing but we're unable to do, because basically countries are beginning to get tired of refugees. They're saying, hey, all these countries creating all these refugees, why don't they do, you know, shape up and stop it? And we have to remember that there are another 26 million people who have been not allowed to cross an international frontier because the neighboring countries won't let them in. So actually, when you look at the figures, one in every 115 people on Earth today has been driven from their home by human rights abuses, ethnic cleansing, murder, torture, that kind of thing.
And what does UNHCR do well at the moment, and what are its current failings in your view?
Well, we're coping for instance, in Goma. We had 1 million people come into a little town with practically no airfield, a town made of lava rock with no water available, in 4 days, and we lost an awful lot of them in the first couple of weeks. Now we're beginning to cope. We're basically there as the firemen of the UN. We're the emergency SWAT teams. We go in where no one else wants to go. We go into conflict situations. We go where people are fighting and shooting and killing each other and shooting at humanitarian aid workers, too. And we try and to be a calming presence. In some places it works for a while, in some places it doesn't. Like in Yugoslavia, we have 4 or 5 months at a time where we were able to really get food to all the people who are hungry, and then all of a sudden something happens and we don't feed anybody for a month. It's very, very demoralizing.
Now, you're a press officer for UNHCR, as I've already outlined. Do you get to talk to the people working in the field? And if so, what do they tell you? What sort of things do they tell you?
Well, I go to the field as often as possible. In fact, every month I try to make a trip someplace, usually where there's an emergency, because it's very difficult to talk about something if you don't see it and smell it and feel the fear yourself. I think most of the people in the field who work for UNHCR are young, idealistic, and very, very committed. You don't join the UN to make a lot of money, that's for sure. And a lot of them are lawyers. I think they're angry at what they see. They're angry at what they feel is being used by the international community as a fig leaf for the lack of any political action to resolve these crises. It's so much easier just to throw wheat flour at people and throw cooking oil at them and say, okay, let's keep them alive, rather than really try and resolve these disputes before they go so far that tens of thousands of people are dying.
I've got about 40 seconds left, and I want to fire a couple of quick questions at you. Would you mind?
Sure.
A couple of quick questions. Are you married?
No, I'm not.
Do you have long hours at work yourself?
I usually get here about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm rarely out of here before 11 o'clock at night.
Well, that's extraordinary. I mean, well, how do you relax?
I love my job.
Do you?
This is relaxation for me. I'm having a wonderful time. This is the most exciting time of my whole life.
Silvana, very good to talk to you. I mean, I've talked to you several times, and we always enjoy it, and thank you for the information that you provide. And that was our profile of Silvana Foer, press spokesman for UNHCR, living now in Geneva. And why did we talk to Silvana? Well, you may know that LBC and Oxfam are at the moment organising the London People's Plane, which will take off for Goma on August the 26th, full of life-saving equipment. You've heard how committed and enthusiastic Silvana is. If you'd like to make a donation, we need to raise £200,000. And there is a donation line, and here it is. It's 0800 557726. Now, the rake-off for the company organising this is pennies, not pounds, I promise you. Your donation will get through. 0800 557726. Please make a donation. If you would like to organise something to raise money for our appeal, then you can do whatever you'd like to do and register it on this number, 071-605-3555. So two numbers, 0800-557726, if you want to make a donation, credit cards or cash, or if you want to register an event, 071-605-3555. The response has been outstanding. And on behalf of all of us at LBC, thanks very much. Victoria Smith.
Well, starting off in the north, our DHL Mobile's report, Brent Cross, the A41 on the Brent Cross flyover, that's been closed throughout the day because of major repairs, causing one or two problems now, especially bad eastbound on the A406. That's looking slow between Staples Corner and Henley's Corner. Also in Tower Hill, there's been a minor accident there. That's causing some congestion just south of Tower Bridge at the Tower Hill Junction. Wandsworth Bridge roundabout looking slow in northbound there. That's because one lane's been taken out because of roadworks. In New Malden on the A3 Kingston bypass near Bushy Road, southbound lane out there because of emergency gas works. That's starting to slow things up as well. And the Marylebone Road, still very heavy this evening, westbound from the Euston Underpass to Baker Street. Also Bayswater Road a little slow at the junction of Stanhope Place.
The only thing worse than being late is not being able to call ahead and tell them. People's Phone, where talk is cheaper. 0345 1011 12.
Victoria Smith of the LBC Traffic Centre.
Where in the world can you get onto the Information Superhighway for just £199? At PC World with the Hey Secura 144. This fast and reliable fax and data modem comes complete with a membership kit to CompuServe, the online information service for PC users. We'll even give you a month's free membership. So get yourself connected at PC World for just £199 plus VAT at 17.5%. Hey Secura plus CompuServe, your gateway to the online world. PC World.
Ultimate Gold Collection. All your favorite tracks on one sensational album. 40 classic cuts on one double CD and cassette. Over 2 hours of solid gold action. Featuring Joey Rafferty, Fleetwood Mac, Chris Rea, Robert Palmer, and many more. The Ultimate Gold Collection. Available from Woolworths and all good record stores.
Where in the world can I find Britain's biggest computer superstore? At Staples Corner, Lakeside Retail Park, Croydon, Brentford and Medway. PC
World. This is Peter Dealey. Dry time is my time, each weekday between 4 and 7 on LBC News Talk 97.3 FM. MPs stand for election roughly every 5 years. We are voted in every day by hundreds of thousands of Londoners who elect to turn their radios on. We have no office but the one we broadcast from, no platform but the truth. But radio makes waves. That ends this non-political broadcast.
Now, after the news from Louise, we'll be looking at success for the French. After 20 years, they've caught the world's most wanted terrorist, Carlos the Jackal. Go to Paris for the reaction to that, and also ask who is the world's most wanted terrorist now. And on the eve of the pension ombudsman's report into complaints he's received, we assess the state of the pensions industry. And we look at LBC transforming into two new stations in October. All that after the news.
LBC News Talk 97.3. News.
It's 8 o'clock. This is Louise Whitefield. It's emerged that one of the world's most wanted terrorists, handed over to French officials today, used London as a base for his terror campaigns in the 1970s. Carlos the Jackal has been linked with 83 murders worldwide. He was arrested in the Sudan and will now stand trial in France. From Paris, Jasper Mortimer reports.
Interior Minister Charles Pasqua said Carlos was arrested yesterday in Sudan
After France had tipped off the Sudanese authorities, he might be living there under a false identity. He was flown to Paris, where he landed at a military airport this morning. He is now in the city's Sante prison and will appear before an investigating magistrate tomorrow. He will be questioned on a bomb attack near the Champs-Élysées in 1982, which killed one person and wounded 63 others.
The IRA has admitted planting two bike bombs on the south coast. The terrorists say the attacks were made on the eve of the 25th anniversary of troops arriving in Northern Ireland. 15 shops were severely damaged by an explosion in Bognor. Police say the other device found at Brighton was twice as big. It was blown up by experts. The European Union has admitted the Employment Secretary Michael Portillo may have been right to scrap a job support scheme for disabled workers. He had insisted an EU directive left him no choice but to cancel the priority suppliers deal. The European Commission now admits there may have been a legal problem, but says it never intended to outlaw schemes promoting opportunities for disabled workers. The flagship Conservative Council of Wandsworth is being accused of palming off homeless people onto other London boroughs. The BBC's Panorama programme will allege tonight that more than half the homeless families placed by Wandsworth in private accommodation have been sent to Lambeth, Merton and Croydon. The Health Secretary, Virginia Bottomley, has dismissed Labour claims that the government is preparing to sell off parts of the NHS. The opposition health spokesman David Blunkett has said the government is prepared to see the service run by people whose only motive is profit. But Mrs. Bottomley says talk of a sale to US firms is a monstrous fiction. Police in London are demanding more resources in reaction to the murder of a teenager near St. Pancras Station. 15-year-old Richard Everett was stabbed to death by a gang of Asian youths. His family is planning to move out of the Somerstown area. The police have appealed for the public not to take the law into their own hands following the murder. The chairman of the Met Police Federation, Mike Bennett, says more officers are needed on the streets.
For an individual to walk the streets in these days is dangerous. For a group of individuals will be equally as dangerous. And it's just a cheap option. Something that may work in Sandwich in Kent will not work in the inner cities in London. And it's all about money.
In the city, the 100 share index closed down 0.1 at 31.42.2. The latest Dow Jones is up 0.32 at 37.69.03. London's weather, currently 20 degrees. This evening, dry and bright with bright spells. Tonight, staying dry but becoming misty in places. Overnight temperatures around 14 degrees in central London. Tomorrow, warm, dry and bright. Temperatures up to 22 degrees with a chance of a shower by the afternoon. It's 3 minutes past eight.
Now, as you heard in the news, the world's most wanted man, Carlos the Jackal, has been captured in the Sudan, in the capital Khartoum, after more than 20 years on the run. His arrest is being seen as a triumph for the French security forces in their fight against international terrorism. The Venezuelan master of disguise, real name Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez, is thought to be responsible for dozens of murders. He's said to have coughed to 88. Most notoriously, the massacre of Israeli athletes in the 1972 Munich Olympics. Well, the Jackal has now been extradited to Paris, where he's awaiting trial at a top security prison. And on the line now from the French capital, I'm joined by Reuters correspondent Alistair Doyle. Alistair, what specific crimes is Carlos the Jackal accused of?
Well, as you mentioned, he's accused of more than 80 killings worldwide, according to the French Interior Minister today. And a string of murders from the early 1970s, starting perhaps with